Hello, everybody. Great to be with you. My name is Michael Millerman, millermanschool.com. And today I wanted to talk with you about Palantir and some ideas they have, in particular their CEO, Alex Karp, has about the role of technology in politics and a kind of need for tech entrepreneurs to consider the basic concepts of political philosophy. So this is an article from Time that came out not long ago. I think it was about less than a week ago or so. There's a co-author, Nicholas Zamyska. You see Dr. Karp is co-founder and CEO of Palantir. Zamyska is head of corporate affairs at the company and so on. So it's a nice piece. And I think that you're going to have to pay more attention to people like Karp, Thiel, Mark Andreessen, people in the software world, people who are brilliant entrepreneurs, investors, financiers, and so on, all of whom are recognizing the need for political philosophy to inform their understanding of the world. You can look at Mark Andreessen's recommended reading lists and you'll find some philosophers there. You can look at Peter Thiel's Straussian Moment, which I covered on the channel not too long ago. And today we're going to look at Karp. And by the way, very nice that Karp and Zamyska have this book coming out next year, Technological Republic, which I assume will be well worth our attention. Okay, so let's look at this, and then I have a few other things on the topic that we can go over together. In 1976, Frank Collin, an ambitious leader in the small but resilient Nazi Party of the United States, planned a march in Skokie, Illinois, an attempt to raise the profile of his organization and build support for his cause. The town, many of whose residents were Jewish and had lived through the war, vehemently opposed the demonstration, and the case went to the courts. The American Civil Liberties Union came to the legal defense of Collin and his fellow Nazis on First Amendment grounds, a move that would be almost unthinkable today. Arya Nair, the national executive director of the ACLU at the time, received thousands of letters condemning his organization's decision to defend the free speech rights of Nazis. Nair was born into a Jewish family in Berlin, 1937, and fled from Germany to England along with his parents as a child. He later estimated that 30,000 ACLU members left the organization as a result of its decision to come to the legal defense of the Nazi demonstrators. His interest in protecting Collin's right to free speech under the First Amendment was not rooted in an unthinking commitment to liberalism or its values. He instead held two seemingly contradictory, yet deeply felt and genuine beliefs. In the abhorrence of Collin's view, you know, of the Nazi teaching, as well as the importance of defending his right to express them against infringement by the state. To defend myself, I must restrain power with freedom, even if the temporary beneficiaries are the enemies of freedom, he later wrote. His beliefs had a cost, and their defense required putting the credibility of his organization and himself at risk. Okay, I'll pause here for a minute because those of you following world geopolitics in any capacity probably know that this idea that an organization can have beliefs, those beliefs can have a cost, and the defense of those beliefs can upset some people. Well, Palantir have their own version of that, as you see, for example, in this article, also from Time Magazine, also from this month, called How Tech Giants Turned Ukraine into an AI War Lab. And you see this one begins early on the morning of June 1st, 2022. Alex Karp, CEO of Palantir, data analytics firm Palantir Technologies, crossed the border between Poland and Ukraine on foot with five colleagues in tow, and so on and so on. We can take a look at this later, but this is about how Palantir has put their technological prowess in the defense industry and in the data analytics side of things behind Ukraine versus Russia and behind Israel versus Palestine. So also some very clear geopolitical commitments from Palantir, this view that you have to have beliefs and the defense of those beliefs. So I think Karp is somebody who's become very vocal about that lately. And in this particular article, you'll see that he invokes some basic concepts of political thought, political theory, or political philosophy, which I thought was a nice thing for us to look at. So the congressional testimony late last year by the The congressional testimony late last year by the presidents of Harvard, the University of Pennsylvania, and MIT, the first two of whom resigned from their positions, raises similar issues to those that arose in Skokie nearly half a century ago, including the familiar tension between protecting free speech rights and guarding against attempts to alienate and subjugate the other. But the testimony also exposed a far more significant and fundamental challenge that we in the US and the West face. You guys probably know this, maybe most famously the one pictured here, Claudine Gay, who resigned from her post. She was, among other things, on the receiving end of a very effective propaganda campaign by Chris Rufo. Interestingly as well, I guess I can tell you, there's a piece about Chris Rufo and a good journal I've written for before called I Am 1776, out in The Guardian today. So these are all of these reflections are on point, okay? But taking down Claudine Gay and so on. So what's this more significant and fundamental challenge that we in the US and the West face? A broad swath of leaders in the US, from academic administrators and politicians to executives in Silicon Valley, have for years often been punished mercilessly for publicly mustering anything approaching an authentic belief. The public arena and the shallow and petty assaults against those who dare to do something other than enrich themselves has become so unforgiving that the Republic is left with a significant roster of ineffectual and often hollow vessels whose ambition one would forgive if there were any genuine belief structure lurking within. Okay, so you can say what you think about that. That's a pretty damning indictment, isn't it? That basically they're shallow vessels. The Republic, the technological republic, the topic of the book that these authors have coming out next year, okay, is left with a significant roster of ineffectual and often hollow vessels. Ambition, but no substance. Ambition, but no genuine belief structure. The current system in Silicon Valley leaves little room for capable and original thinkers whose principal motivation is something other than self-promotion, and who often lack a willingness to subject themselves to the theater and vicissitudes of the modern public sphere. Okay, so you can infer here, he would like there to be capable and original thinkers in Silicon Valley. It's going to need a sort of systemic change for that to happen. You want people whose motivation is not just this self-promotion. You want thoughtful people, okay? People who have some understanding of the geopolitics, the political theology, the political philosophy, the political theory. Think about Bukele in El Salvador when he speaks about why his nation is on the uprise, why it's getting better, why it's not in decline, because he says that there are values that make a country great, and that the Western world has abandoned those values and therefore is in decline, and El Salvador has picked them up and is therefore in ascension. So here too, the question is, well, are you just ignoring all question of direction, aim, purpose, and value, the substantial issues, and just focused on self-promotion, ambition, and enrichment? Or can Silicon Valley stand for something more? Okay, that's where, as I say, all the broader reflections come in. An entire generation of executives and entrepreneurs that came of age in recent years was essentially robbed of an opportunity to form actual views about the world, both descriptive, what it is, and normative, what it should be, leaving us with a managerial class whose principal purpose often seems to be little more than ensuring its own survival and recreation. Okay, so these are the elites who never went through a genuine education. What is political philosophy properly? It's both descriptive and normative. It tells you about the nature of political things, and it tells you about the best life for the political community and the best life for the individual. But an entire generation of executives and entrepreneurs was robbed of that opportunity. Okay, and so we have a managerial class that lacks proper education. The result is that many of those in power have become so fearful of offending anyone. And if you're online at all, then you know that the Google image AI is just about proof of how badly that can go. The result is that many of those in power who have become so fearful of offending anyone that one would be forgiven for assuming, based on their public statements, that their interior lives and most intimate thoughts had recoiled into something small and shallow. Okay, once again, I interject here. Philosophy is all about making sure that the most intimate thoughts are not small and shallow, but are comprehensive and deep and verging on madness and on divinity. Okay, you go to the utmost limits of heaven and hell if you philosophize truly. The perverse and unintended result is that corporations selling consumer goods feel the need to develop and indeed broadcast their views on issues affecting our moral or interior lives, while software companies with the capacity and perhaps duty to shape our geopolitics remain conspicuously silent, okay? This kind of thing should intrigue you. Software companies with the capacity to shape our geopolitics, that's important. And with the duty to shape our geopolitics, that's important. You know, so in either formulation here, you have to know something about geopolitics. So those of you who know me, know my work, know my channel, okay, I learned a lot about what I know concerning the foundations of geopolitics from the Russian thinker Alexander Dugin, several of whose books I myself have translated and who I teach privately and in courses in my school. You know, you want to understand geopolitics, you got to study people who say something about geopolitics, okay? Here's Dugin's Last War of the World Island, Geopolitics of Contemporary Russia. So software companies may have the capacity, they may even have the duty to shape geopolitics, but that means that they have to study and understand geopolitics. At Palantir, we build software and artificial intelligence capabilities, the authors continue, for defense and intelligence agencies in the United States and its allies across Europe and the world. Our work has been controversial, and not everyone will agree with our decision to build products, including software, that enables offensive weapons systems for the U.S. military. I want to say something about that in a minute. But we have made a choice, notwithstanding its costs and complications. Okay, just like the opening anecdote, right, where the person had to make a choice to protect the free speech of Nazis, notwithstanding the costs and complications. So to Palantir is making a choice to support the U.S. military, notwithstanding costs and complications. Many overlook the benefits. As a deputy to James Mattis, who would later become U.S. Defense Secretary, as a deputy to James Mattis, who would later become U.S. Defense Secretary, once wrote, in an internal request within the Defense Department for access to Palantir's software, according to an article on Our Work and Fortune, Marines are alive today because of the capability of the system. Sorry, I have somebody printing. Sorry for the background noise. Okay. Marines are alive today because of the capability of Palantir's systems. So that's a benefit. Okay, you choose to support the U.S. military, you can also save the lives of U.S. Servicemen and women. No small feat there. The congressional testimony by the university presidents exposed the bargain that contemporary elite culture has made to retain power. That belief itself in anything other than oneself, perhaps, is dangerous and to be avoided. Okay? Don't go all in on that position. Don't speak in terms of right and wrong, good and bad. Now, you know, the weird thing is that, I'm going to pause, obviously, to comment on this. The weird thing is that you could say, no, I mean, a lot of these tech companies have clearly asserted some position about what's good and what's bad, what's just and unjust. Their position tends to fall on the DEI side of the equation, which is why people like Musk are going after them relentlessly and others are going after them relentlessly. So they're not so much neutral as they are inimical towards and to basic American values, you know? But okay, fine. We'll take up this line of argumentation nevertheless. Just follow it out as he plays it out. The Silicon Valley establishment has grown so suspicious and fearful of an entire category of thought, including contemplations on culture or national identity, that anything approaching a worldview is seen as a liability. Now, when I first read this, sometimes I read articles with you that I haven't read. Sometimes I read ones that I have read. This one I did read. And this, to me, was one of the most important lines here. So the Silicon Valley establishment has grown so suspicious and fearful of what? Of an entire category of thought. And I think we can call that category political theory, political philosophy. Okay? Contemplations on culture or national identity. That's what Dugin does. That's what Heidegger sometimes does, okay, when he says that the question, what is a people, is an essential passageway for philosophy. So there's a contemplation there on what constitutes peoplehood or what is a people. Okay, Leo Strauss's analyses, Schmitt's analyses, these are all in a category of thought that includes contemplations on culture or national identity. And Silicon Valley, having become suspicious and fearful of that category of thought, it now sees anything approaching a worldview as a liability. And my thought, in a way, my hunch, my thesis, and I have evidence for this because I run an online school where I teach Strauss, Heidegger, Schmitt, Dugin and all these other people. And early on, I noticed that most of the people coming to me who really wanted to know, who were intelligent, who were interested, who will invest the time and the money and everything, the intellectual resources, okay, they were in tech, software, startup world, entrepreneurs, in some cases VCs, in some cases funders, okay, investors. But they're in that tech entrepreneur world. And they have their leading lights, people like Thiel. Now, you can't be interested in Thiel and not also be thoughtful when Thiel's the author of an essay like The Straussian Moment, which mentions Leo Strauss and Girard and Carl Schmitt. Okay? And you can't get interested in those people without going deeper and wanting to know about Heidegger and about contemporary Heideggerians, for example, Alexander Dugin. So you realize, look, people in tech are, some of them are behind the curve. Those are the ones that Karp is criticizing, but some of them are ahead of the curve. And they know something in the world is changing. They're trying to understand what it is. There's a return of the political. That's how the Straussian moment opens, okay? The 9/11 attacks is the return of political theology into the consciousness of Western liberals. So tech guys get it, okay? People in the tech world, women included, okay? I've had private tutoring students in software, tech, entrepreneurship, and financing who are reading Heidegger with me, who are women. So when I say tech guys, I mean, okay, men and women. So it's a very big deal here, all right? And everybody else is behind. Everybody else is suspicious and fearful. Everybody else sees worldview as a liability. Okay, I continue now with the article. The halting testimony of the university presidents when asked about anti-Semitism on campus was significant not because of its content, but because of its cool precision and calculation, embodying the archetype of the new administrative class, clinical and careful, and above all, without feeling. The problem is that those who say nothing wrong often say nothing much at all. If you do not feel it, you will not get it by hunting for it, Goethe reminds us in Faust. You will never touch the hearts of others if it does not emerge from your own. Incidentally, also a problem for many philosophy professors. Try to teach philosophy without realizing it's an all-consuming fire. The presidents struck many as wholly unaware of the internal contradictions of their position, contradictions stemming from their commitment to free speech on the one hand, but also the eagerness of their institutions in various other contexts to carefully patrol the use of language. I want to pause for a minute, just super briefly. One other connection here between tech, software, startup, entrepreneurship and all of that, and political philosophy. I mean, we're talking here about reflections on culture, national identity, political theology, geopolitics. That's one part of it, for sure. But so too, like large language models, you think who else besides the people doing the sort of matrix algebra or whatever is behind the transformer models, they need to think about, well, where, you know, the nature of language, the nature of a logic, of what a human-like linguistic model means for the phenomenology, for basic phenomenology and questions of ethics and morality and the control over those systems. I mean, this is like people who are in that world right now are forced to think about philosophy. In fact, sorry, if I can just go off script here once more for a minute, I did have queued up to show you. Here's an example. I didn't listen to this interview of Bill Ackman on artificial intelligence podcast, Lex Friedman podcast, okay? But apparently, he said on it that he recommends Sartre's Essays in Existentialism as required reading for new investors at his firm. Okay, so once again, showing you that people who are in tech, finance, and so on, they are finding resources for understanding themselves and the world, meaning crisis, the changing order, and all of that in the works of philosophers. But all right. Fine, let's go here. Let me get back on track. Where are we? The presidents, we read that. Yeah, see, I'll tell you. It was this right here. Patrolling the use of language. That's what made me think of the large language models, because you know there's a big question. What answers they're willing to give, what questions they're willing to field, what formulations they're willing to use, right? Our culture more broadly has, for the most part, successfully pounded down any notes or errant hints of zeal and feeling in those leading our most significant institutions. And what remains beneath the polish is often unclear. When we require the systematic elimination of the thorns, barbs, and flaws that necessarily accompany genuine human contact and confrontation with the world, we lose something else. The work of Irving Goffman, a Canadian-born sociologist, on what he described as quote-unquote total institutions may be instructive here. In a collection of essays published in 1961 titled Asylums, Goffman defines such institutions, total institutions, which include prisons and mental hospitals, as places, quote, where a large number of like-situated individuals cut off from the wider society for an appreciable period of time, together lead an enclosed, formally administered round of life, end quote. The same might be said of some of our nation's most elite universities, which have nominally and belatedly opened their doors to a far broader swath of participants, but whose internal cultures remain remarkably cloistered and walled off from the world. In the late 1960s, guys, give me one second here. I'm just going to drink my coffee. Let me throw some comments on screen. Hopefully that's all right. There you go. Thank you for being here. Nice to spend time with you. Hope you're enjoying this. It's always good to see intelligent people like Alex Karp write about topics that give us something to work through and think about. And this AI tech software entrepreneur / political philosophy nexus, you know, or the tech entrepreneur as a mystic and prophet, another good idea from, believe it or not, Peter Thiel's Zero to One. These are all things worth considering carefully. All right, here we go. Picking up with the article. We're reading by Alex Karp and this other person. Okay, wait, I'll tell you. For people who tuned in, I always like to give credit so you know what it is we're reading. Time Magazine, Silicon Valley Has a Harvard Problem, authored by Alex Karp and Nicholas Zamyska, both from Palantir. Okay, back to where we were. In the late 1960s, an earlier generation of university administrators, including Kingman Brewster Jr. at Yale, took a different path when it came to confronting and embracing a challenge to entrenched power and elite privilege. A series of civil rights demonstrations involving the Black Panthers and others engulfed Yale's campus in May 1970, and at least two bombs exploded in the school's ice hockey rink. What's going on? It's not letting me scroll properly. There was a willingness, however, by Brewster and others to venture into the ethical morass of the moment in a way that would ensure a swift and summary cancellation in the U.S. today. In April 1970, at a meeting of hundreds of Yale faculty members in New Haven, Connecticut, Brewster said that he was, quote, skeptical of the ability of Black revolutionaries to achieve a fair trial anywhere in the United States, unquote, according to a report in the New York Times the following day. He had ventured into the conflagration, not away from it. Spiro Agnew, the vice president of the United States, promptly called for Brewster to resign. He did not, however, and ultimately emerged stronger as a result of the thwarted assault on his reign. We have perhaps arrived at a point when we must again embrace the possibility, as Jeffrey Cabaservice has written, that Brewster and others did at Yale, that our highest responsibility might be to unsettle the status quo rather than preserve it. So again, this is Karp giving you historical examples of the way that universities once were, and organizations and institutions once were, but no longer are. Now they're spineless cowards, summarizing. Okay. And they no longer feel like their highest responsibility might be to unsettle the status quo. And clearly that is what Karp believes that Palantir must now do. And that's what he's trying to accomplish, I guess, not only in the actions of the company, but also in these public pronouncements like this one in Time Magazine. Another good thing about this article, as we continue reading it, is a mention of Alan Bloom, very important in my circles, you could say. Alan Bloom, a student of Leo Strauss's, author of Closing of the American Mind, translator of Plato's Republic, great scholar of Rousseau. Many people discover political philosophy by reading Bloom's Closing of the American Mind, incidentally. So let's see what Karp says about all of that. Alan Bloom, who taught at the University of Chicago more than three decades ago, articulated the challenge that we currently face in his 1987 polemic, The Closing of the American Mind. Our commitment to openness, a vital and uncontroversially necessary good, he wrote, has driven out the local deities, leaving only the speechless, meaningless country. Bloom continued, there's no immediate sensual experience of the nation's meaning or its project, which would provide the basis for adult reflection on regimes and statesmanship. Students now arrive at the university ignorant and cynical about our political heritage, lacking the wherewithal to be either inspired by it or seriously critical of it. In the late 1980s, Bloom was focused on the interior and intellectual lives of university students, but it is those students who are now our administrators. And you should know, I think Bloom's original title for his book was Souls Without Longing. So the students that he described as souls without longing are now our administrators. Okay, administrators without purpose, without direction, without understanding. And the culture in which those administrators have been raised has been unforgiving, systematically punishing anything approaching moral courage and incentivizing its opposite. I'm interjecting all over the place here. I hope you guys don't mind. I think I saw a clip of Peter Thiel recently saying that, something like intelligence is, needless to say, extremely important, but courage is even more rare these days, something along those lines. Okay, so in this way, the university presidents are victims of their and our collective focus on the policing of language, and by extension, thought, combined with the enforcement of elaborate yet unpublished codes regarding behavior, that together deprive individuals of the habit and instinct required to develop sincerely held and authentic beliefs, as well as the gall to express them. You guys all know what he's talking about, right? You can't show an interest in fascist thinkers, quote unquote. Dugin is not one, but I'm saying from the point of view of the typical liberal, you're automatically suspicious. Not just that, not just Dugin, you know. Evola, Gwenon, Schmidt, in some circles even Strauss, for sure Heidegger, maybe even Nietzsche. All of these things are red flags. Don't go there. You know, you have to, that's extreme. That is not only, that's the extreme of the extreme. You know, there are people, I had students when I was a teaching assistant at the University of Toronto who told me that they were effectively under investigation or under suspicion, probably a better way of looking at it, under suspicion, just for an interest in Peterson, Jordan Peterson, okay? I'm not even talking about Schmidt, Heidegger. Okay, nothing against Peterson, but I mean, there's a difference, okay? There's a difference in taking a deep interest in people like Schmidt, taking a deep interest in people like Peterson. But even that was a bridge too far. So you see the problem, right? Depriving individuals of the habit and instinct required to develop sincerely held and authentic beliefs, as well as the gall to express them. That's a war against the human soul. That's a war against philosophy. That's a war against intelligence. That's no good. Okay, so that's why I like this piece, because it's Karp fighting back. Michael Sandel, a professor at Harvard Law School, anticipated the contradictions that arise from our fierce commitment in the West to classical liberalism and its elevation, if not preference, for individual rights at the expense of anything approaching collective purpose or identity, as well as our cultural reticence to venture into many of the most meaningful and significant moral debates of our time. It is this fundamental abdication of responsibility for articulating a coherent and rich vision of the world and of shared purpose that has left us unable to confront issues with moral clarity or true conviction. Another formulation, okay? He doesn't say the words political philosophy in this essay, but he mentions Sandel, he mentions Bloom. He's got these very much on point formulations, okay? Fundamental abdication of responsibility for articulating a coherent and rich vision of the world and of shared purpose. And this has left us unable to confront issues with moral clarity or true conviction. Yeah, that's what happens when you don't allow people to think and when political philosophy is on the verge of dying. Okay, every time it's on the verge of dying, it needs somebody to come and resuscitate it. Strauss did that, 40 years ago, and now we're doing it. Okay, I mean, those of you who are here and interested in this topic and who are writing about it and so on. The consequences of this reticence, where liberals fear to tread, as Sandel famously put it, are now being made clear. Quote, where political discourse lacks moral resonance, the yearning for a public life of larger meanings finds undesirable expressions, he wrote in Liberalism and the Limits of Justice. As a result, our broader cultural discourse shrinks down into something small and petty, becoming increasingly preoccupied with the scandalous, the sensational, and the confessional, Sandel wrote. His broader critique was that a certain narrowness of modern liberalism, quote, is too spare to contain the moral energies of a vital democratic life, and thus creates a moral void that opens the way for the intolerant, the trivial, and other misguided moralisms, unquote. That void is now being revealed. You can take issue with it if you want to in the chat or in the comments, but I would say it's spot on. While our collective focus has been trained on the nation's most elite educational institutions, right? So he's writing here in the aftermath of the firings of Claudine Gay and all of that. So while our collective focus has been trained on the nation's most elite educational institutions, Silicon Valley and the tech companies that now control vast swaths of the global economy may soon be facing a similar reckoning. So I want to tell you very quickly, okay, well, I'll mark this so we can come back to it. The article is called, right here, Silicon Valley has a Harvard problem. You know, we have a little bit about Harvard and the universities and all of that. But the much more interesting thesis, in my view, you know, forget about the Harvard problem. Silicon Valley, in effect, you know, the real title of this piece, in my view, is Silicon Valley Needs Political Philosophy. Harvard, okay, Harvard's a distraction. Maybe. Silicon Valley needs political philosophy. That's the main point. That's what we're emphasizing throughout. That's why I think he gets to mention Bloom and Sandel. And that's why he's making his transition now to what lies ahead. Silicon Valley and the tech companies that now control vast swaths of the global economy may soon be facing a similar reckoning. The leaders of Silicon Valley, who have constructed technical empires that structure and shape our lives, were for the most part raised in a contemporary culture deeply skeptical of substance and authentic belief. The principal sin for this cohort is to offend. A certain pragmatism and insensitivity to calculation has been lost on them. This emerging technological class, the masters of this new universe that we inhabit, willingly or otherwise, often points to software and artificial intelligence as our salvation. Let me just pause here really quickly, okay? I've expressed this before with some people in private tutoring and in some other contexts, but I want to give it to you here in a nutshell, okay? This is too much to elaborate on the spot since our focus is the article, but I want to give it to you very quickly here. Tech entrepreneurs are the new philosopher kings, okay? In effect. But in order to be a philosopher king, you have to have some familiarity with political philosophy. So they had the power. They're ahead of the law. They have the intelligence. They've got momentum and advantage in all of these different ways. They are, quote, the masters of this new universe that we inhabit willingly or otherwise. And yet, they have been deprived of the philosopher side of their technological kingship in their education. That's Karp's thesis, okay? You could sort of summarize it like that. Okay, these are the people who are trying to make this new combination of how do you look towards insights on language, on human existence, on power, on the relationship of technology and law, on the question of the gods, the return of the strong gods, political theology, geopolitics, and all the rest of it, reflections on peoplehood and identity. And, okay, they now need not just software, not just artificial intelligence, but as we saw many times throughout this piece, a proper education that can allow them to articulate and defend well-reasoned convictions. Okay, fine. So this emerging technological class often points to software and artificial intelligence as our salvation. They believe, to be sure, but principally in themselves and in the power of their creations, stopping short of entering into a discourse with the most significant questions of our time, including the broader project of the nation and its reason for being. Ladies and gentlemen, this means stopping short of philosophy. Okay, that's what this means. They stop short of philosophy, entering into a discourse with the most significant questions of our time and of all time, including the broader project of the nation and its reason for being. They are building, but we should ask for what purpose and why. The risk is that we have enabled a new class of technological leadership whose capacity for forming its own authentic beliefs about the world has been severely diminished. And that absence leaves them vulnerable to becoming instruments for the plans and designs of others. An entire generation is at risk of being deprived of the opportunity to think critically about the world or its place in it. Huh? It is this, you know what I'm saying? Okay. It is this productization of the American mind, in addition to its closing, that we must guard against. A significant subset of Silicon Valley undoubtedly scorns the masses for their guns and religion. But that subset itself clings to something, a thin and meager secular ideology that masquerades as thought. Okay. This is rousing. Are you not aroused? Are you not roused? Are you not fired up? Listen to what he's saying. Listen to what's missing. It's all the things that whether, you know, look at, it doesn't mean everybody has to come to the same conclusions. It doesn't mean that everybody has to have the same answer to the question of the broader project of the nation, the same answer to the question of its reason for being. They don't have to think identically about the most significant questions of the time. But you can't stop short of those questions. So anybody who says not to is a friend of mine, okay? Regardless of where the chips fall after that fact. The shallow and thinly veiled nihilism of a corporate slogan such as "Don't be evil," which Google adopted when the company went public in 2004 and later exchanged for the similarly banal "Do the right thing," captures the views of a generation of extraordinarily talented software engineers who were taught to prize the identification of and resistance to evil over the more difficult and often messy task of navigating the world in all its imperfection. In April 2018, for example, more than 3,000 Google employees sent an open letter to Sundar Pichai, the company's chief executive officer, demanding that he halt a project with the U.S. Department of Defense on developing software for use by the American military around the world. Google should not be in the business of war, the employees wrote, insisting that the company agree never to build warfare technology. Okay, so they didn't want their company doing business with the military-industrial complex. By the way, let me just pause for a second, because this idea of criticizing researchers or tech companies for working with the government or working especially on behalf of the defense agencies or defense departments or departments of war, there was a nice article on that topic that I have to tell you about, but I need just a second to pull it up. It was about Chomsky. Maybe you know the name. Chomsky at MIT, a linguist. And the article was, oh, I have to share it with you, okay? Give me 1 minute. Okay. You'll have to find it, or I'll have to find it for you. Ah, should I look? It's a great article. Really worth reading. I saw it on aldaily.com. Okay, a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago. AL Daily, that's artsandlettersdaily.com. A nice, here, I guess I'll just put this up on screen. I have to, because it's worth, you know, it's worth reading. 2023. Okay, anyway, look around for it. It was a good, good article on Chomsky's time at MIT and how he was doing work that the defense agencies wanted. They wanted his research into linguistics, but he had to kind of isolate for himself the theoretical side of his work from its practical application. Fascinating psychological study, but I won't bore you with the details because I can't find them. All right, where are we here? The problem is not a principled commitment to pacifism or nonviolence. It is a more fundamental abandonment of belief in anything. The employees who resisted leveraging the machinery of Google in the service of building software for the US military know what they oppose, but not what they are for. Boy, we could say so much about every sentence written here, okay? Knowing what you oppose, but not what you are for. You see, up here, if you go up here, right? A shallow and thinly veiled nihilism, okay? Then we go down here, right? Not knowing what you're for, just knowing what you're against. There's a good article you should read by Leo Strauss, German Nihilism, which gets into the view of nihilism as something that just says no, but doesn't know what it's for, and how important it is to start to articulate the question of, well, what should we be for, and why political philosophy is helpful in that regard too, because it gives you various models you can actually think through and assess. But all right, I promise I'm going to stop going off the rails. Let's pick it up here. So they know what they oppose, militarism and all of that, but not what they are for. The company at its core builds elaborate and extraordinarily lucrative mechanisms to monetize the placement of advertising for consumer goods and services that accompany search results. Okay, that's his characterization of Google. That service is vital and has remade the world, but the business and a significant subset of its employees stop short of engaging with more fundamental and essential questions of national purpose and identity, another formulation of what political philosophy might do, with an affirmative vision of what we want to do and should be building as part of a national project, not simply an articulation of the lines that one will not cross. You know, like, don't accidentally offend somebody. Don't suggest that, you know, whatever, you know, think about Google's latest image AI fiasco. They remain content to monetize our search histories, but decline to defend our collective security. The entire company, however, along with any number of Silicon Valley's largest technology enterprises, owe their existence in significant part to the educational culture as well as the legal protections and capital markets of the US. Some perhaps tell themselves they're involved in a broader project, but the mere association of oneself with an ideology or political movement and resulting feeling of adjacency to engagement and proximity to action too often masquerades as actual belief or thought. Okay, something else worth thinking about, right? Just being an activist is not the same as thinking. Just being associated with an ideology is not the same as well-reasoned belief, something that you hold not just with the bare intensity of conviction, but with a basis. As Henry Kissinger reminds us, according to Paul Kennedy in The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, nations should be judged on what they did, not on their domestic ideology. We should also remember that it is the systematic expression and investigation of one's own beliefs, the essential purpose of genuine education, that remains our best defense against the mind becoming a product or vehicle for the ambitions of another. Once again, I hope you don't mind my pointing out a beautiful formulation here of just how important true education is. Okay, and true education means philosophy. In the end, the nation, this collective attempt at not merely self-governance, but the construction of a shared and common life, if not purpose, will decide whether it wants Silicon Valley to believe in anything other than the power of its own creations. The technology companies that this country has built have, for the most part, deftly navigated around any issues that would draw undue scrutiny or unwanted attention. The hallmark of their mode of being is avoidance and often silence. Let me just interject here. It's not true fully of Elon Musk. You know, he has had some conspicuous public role in US-Russia, if you can remember those instances yourself, and there may be other ones that I don't know about. But I would say, you know, he, like Thiel, like Palantir, they're all outliers. The current silence is a symptom of a broader reticence to offend and to permit ourselves and those around us to err. Okay, to make mistakes. In one particular haunting scene from George Orwell's 1984, Winston Smith, his protagonist, finds himself wandering through a wooded area, seemingly far from the reach of the state's dystopian minders. Even then, secluded and almost assuredly free from observation, Smith imagines that a microphone might be concealed in the trees through which some small beetle-like man would be listening intently. The dystopian future that Orwell and others have imagined may be near, but not because of the surveillance state or contraptions built by Silicon Valley giants that rob us of our privacy or most intimate moments alone. It is we, another strong closing sentence and argument worth considering, it is we, not our technical creations, who are to blame for failing to encourage and enable the radical act of belief in something above and beyond and external to the self. Very important, okay? Misleading, like, you could think about this. The title, Silicon Valley Has a Harvard Problem, you know, if skim it, Alex Karp, Palantir, okay, whatever, you know, saying something about Claudine Gay, something about Harvard, la-da-da-da-da, doesn't like Google, okay, defending that, whatever. Implicitly here, defending Palantir's geopolitical orientation. But actually, it's quite an important piece of writing, I would say, with more going on than meets the eye. It is we, not our technical creations, who are to blame for failing to encourage and enable the radical act of belief in something above and beyond and external to the self. This tells us that to think intelligently about the problem of artificial intelligence, tech entrepreneurship, the Silicon Valley philosopher kings, and all of that, you need an account not only of true education. Yes, that's important. That's missing. It's important. Even that kind of lies on the surface, okay? Because even more than that, you have to go into this question. What does it mean for there to be something above and beyond and external to the self? And in my opinion, if you wanted to connect the question of artificial intelligence to analyses of selfhood and to the possible disappearance of the self, to the relationship of our technical creations to radical belief and unbelief and all of that, there are thinkers you could study. One of them, again, in my opinion, do your own homework. I make a recommendation and you act as you see fit. Here's Alexander Dugin. I see somebody had asked about him in the chat. Known for many things, not all of them good. I disagree with him on certain things, Israel, Palestine, among others. But I've translated many of his books. I teach him constantly, many videos on my site, interviews, including some booked for this week. But this, and I'll show you where I pulled it up here, paidauma.tv. Okay. Look up the word Vozu if it helps you, okay, to find this particular video lecture. If you have the patience to sit through an hour and a half of Dugin's lecturing in English with a Russian accent, you'll see what it looks like to start to think at a level of appropriateness about the question of artificial intelligence, human intelligence, and the self. And why that kind of reflection requires, okay, why that kind of lecture requires you to have a familiarity with phenomenology, with philosophy, with the various topographies of human interiority. All right, so as I say, you take an article like this in Time Magazine, right, something above and beyond and external to the self, and you're led, as it were, by the logic of the argument itself to understand what is going on here. What is the relationship between the self, our radical acts of belief, and this quote-unquote something above and beyond and external? Okay, above and beyond and external. Write a book about that, but I just suggest you watch Dugin's lecture on it to start with. Okay, so where are we here? We just finished Alex Karp. I'm excited for his book, okay? The Technological Republic. I think that's going to be a thought-provoking read, okay? A thought-provoking read with more going on than meets the eye, as is true of Thiel's 0-1. Now, something else I thought we might read together, but to be honest, I'm not sure I'm up for it just now. How Tech Giants Turned Ukraine into an AI War. So this would kind of be the application of Karp's defense of civilizational identity and geopolitical positions. I guess this would be an account of how that played out with Palantir's AI support of Ukraine in the current conflict with Russia, which would be an interesting read. But for now, I just show it to you, okay? I'm not going to read it over together on the channel with you. I also want you to know, just on the topic of Palantir and Karp and Thiel, you'll see a video on my channel where I cover Thiel's essay called The Straussian Moment. I myself wrote a response to it published recently at europeanconservative.com called The End of the Straussian Moment? Which, you know, if you're into this topic, you might like to go have a look at that. See, why is Peter Thiel, who's most famous for his work on Girard, titling his most famous essay The Straussian Moment? How do we make sense of that? Okay. Why does Strauss occupy the most conspicuous place in his consideration of the foundations of modern politics? Just be aware of that in case you're interested in the topic. So that's probably enough. I don't want to do an overly long meeting today. See if you can find that article about Chomsky and the military-industrial complex. Boy, I really regret not being able to find it for you. Here's the Dugin thing again. Lecture on the radical subject, highly relevant to the topic of philosophy and artificial intelligence. I'm writing a paper for a collected volume on phenomenology and post-humanism. So I'm doing my research on that topic, which I've always wanted to write about. And that's it. I'll go over to the chat, I guess. I can show you very quickly if you want. You know, I teach online, so I have visionxform.com is one place, kind of philosophy for entrepreneurs, main focus there, and millermanschool.com, where I have a lot of people coming to me from Silicon Valley to study Heidegger, Schmidt, Strauss, Dugin, and all of that, plus this YouTube channel, which you know, so subscribe and comment if you like it. And now let me put your comments on screen and let's walk through some of that. Here we go. So Maxwell, thank you, appreciate it. As I say, we got to give credit where it's due. Okay, Alex Karp coming out in public, writing about political philosophy, education, the need for reflection on geopolitics, asking people to take a stand, criticizing some of his Silicon Valley peers for not going all the way into the genuine fundamental questions that concern us now and always. Renilio is saying something about Dugin. He sincerely detests him. Okay, many people do. Some people don't. No big deal. Pick your poison. read Leo Strauss, Heidegger, Schmidt, Plato, a lot of great authors to choose from. Okay, over the years, I've tried to tell you what I have learned from Dugin. If you're not into it, you're not into it. I see there's some more debate about Dugin in the comments here. In practice, William writes, big tech will fire you if you talk about philosophy of the wrong order. Ask me how I know. Okay, if any of you have a story that you want to share anonymously, don't get yourselves fired on my behalf, but it'd be nice to know if you want to about your experience in the tech world, about overlaps with philosophy, political philosophy, ideology, and all of that. Could be interesting if you want to contribute that, you, William, and anybody else, in the comments to the video. SBF, that's the recently jailed, I guess, Sam Bankman-Friedman, is that his name? Took Peter Singer's ideas to their last consequences. Yes, he's in, well, you can't, you know, I don't know the full background story there, but I know the basic issue that you can't rip people off and expect to get away with it forever. Okay, more debate here about Dugin. Renilio, I've spent many years discussing the things that I learned about Dugin, so you're free to consult any of those materials. I have two books that discuss it, many essays, interviews, podcasts, and so on. Okay, Dugin is one analyst. Doesn't mean you have to agree with everything that he says, but he says things that give us something to think about. Yeah, the possibility of catastrophe. Girard on the logic of prohibitions, where he argues that modern rationalism has made us not believe in catastrophe anymore. Yeah, I would say as well that Thiel's Straussian moment reminds us, if we needed a reminder at the time that it was written and the way it was written, that Western liberals and modern rationalists must incorporate not only the possibility, but the reality of catastrophe into their view. And you know, I've been preparing a course for Millerman School on this incredible book, highly recommended reading, whether you do the course or not, Laws of Plato. It's long, it's difficult, it'll take you some time, don't give up, it's amazing. The Laws of Plato, okay? And the reason I bring it up here is because when they're discussing the origin and transformation of political regimes, they say, isn't it the case that there have been pretty much infinitely many of them over an infinite stretch of time, and they go through certain cycles, and they're reset to zero, basically, by floods and other catastrophes. And so we can imagine that there was a big flood that wiped out a city by the sea, and that the inhabitants who survived fled up into the mountains. And now from their new kind of zero state, okay, or their first post-flood condition, we reconstruct the origin of political community from these separated mountain herdsmen all the way back down to the reestablishment of a city by the sea. So catastrophes are part of political philosophy from the beginning, but the attempt to ignore the possibility of catastrophe makes it all the more likely that you'll be destroyed by one, I guess. Because if you stick your head in the sand, what can you possibly see besides the darkness? What else do we have here? So CVC writes, I could say a few things about the connection between tech and finance, people and philosophy that are not so flattering, I'm sure, and feel free to. Okay, I think it's part of the thesis of Karp's paper here that for most of the cases, the Silicon Valley slash tech slash finance slash entrepreneurs, most of the things you would say about them concerning their relationship to philosophy are not flattering. Therefore, he has this exhortation, as it were. But nevertheless, it is true that there are some people who are very thoughtful and very intelligent and diligent. I know because I study with them. They come to my school and work with me one-on-one, or they get courses on Heidegger, Plato. I'm not saying this as a pitch for the school. I'm telling you, I myself didn't know when I started offering courses online. I didn't have a target demographic. I just wanted to teach, just like right now. I don't know the target demographic of people watching this video. I guess people interested in Palantir, Karp AI, and philosophy. I mean, I know better now, I guess. But when I started, I just wanted to teach. And then people came to me and they were just in software and tech, okay? And interested in Heidegger, Plato, Strauss, and all of that. So yes, it's true that tech people aren't prophets, and it's true that you could say things about them that aren't flattering. And yet, at the peak, there's something about the tech entrepreneurs today and the figure of the philosopher king, and perhaps even the figure of the prophet, not trying to inflate their egos. We're just trying to understand the phenomenon. William writes that YouTube beeped the word male in Sarah Gonzalez's podcast yesterday. Okay, so I guess this is the policing of language. Okay, The Policing of Language, Salty Cyclist. Thank you for your comment. And hold on a second. Wait, I can't see my own chat window here. Everybody else, thank you for your comments. No, I did not get a hold of Alex Karp to talk to him. This was a reading of an essay that he wrote. Okay. A reading of an essay that he wrote. I just thought I'd share it with you, and I hope that you enjoyed it. Okay. Alan Bloom makes an appearance, a nice defense of political philosophy. Keep in mind, you might think he's right about the failures of Silicon Valley to educate themselves more than they do when they are just concerned with nihilistic platitudes. Okay. And nevertheless, you might disagree with the specific geopolitics of Palantir's defense of the West. That's possible. I know I have people who follow me who don't like America and don't like Israel and all of that. You know, you have your geopolitical perspectives here, but his argument gives you some background explanation for why Palantir can confidently defend as it does the West as it sees it, and take the sides that it's taking in these various geopolitical conflicts. And again, I would say the most important takeaways here for me, I love it when people say we need to study. And again, I'm showing you Dugin because I'm tutoring Dugin and I have his books right near me. But if you're going to study geopolitics, you need to study geopolitics, whether you learn that through Schmidt or whether you learn it through anybody else. Thanks for the one thumbs down, whoever that is. I know you had to come and make yourselves heard and make yourselves felt. So, okay, that's it, guys. Any last comments? I don't know. Any last thoughts? Look out for people who have the ability to express something about the relationship in the world today between wisdom and power. I take it for granted that on the wisdom side of the equation, we mean the great works of philosophy and theology. Okay, the peaks of comprehension, of intelligence, of contemplation, of study, of science, of diligence, okay, science in the exalted Aristotelian sense. That's the wisdom side of the equation. The power side of the equation means you're looking for people like Bukele in El Salvador, who on Twitter maybe still does, but definitely used to call himself a philosopher king. You're looking for people like Thiel and Karp, who as leaders of a massive and hugely influential tech company, have the ability to influence geopolitical events, and so on and so on. Heads of universities, heads of state, legislators, financiers, okay? And you want to know the eternally interesting question about the possible relationship of wisdom and power. So Karp's a good example of that. His piece is a good example of that. It was published in Time Magazine. I hope that you enjoy it, and I'll see you in the next live stream. Like, subscribe, share, comment. Anything you choose to do is much appreciated. Take care. Be well. Goodbye.